You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And all of us can certainly say with agreement that we are in a digital age that has affected how we live, work, and play. And as you're going to hear from our two guests today, it's also affected how we give back to society and create social good. With me today is Allison Fine and Beth Cantor, who are two individuals who are highly sought after in the nonprofit sector, and I dare say coveted. They've written a number of books. One book in particular is coming out next year, early 2022. Their new book is called A Smart Nonprofit, Staying Human-Centered in an Automated World. And we're really happy to have both of them here. Allison has also written Momentum, Igniting Social Change in a Connected Age, and Matterness, Fearless Leadership for a Social World. She speaks to social change makers around the world, regularly keynotes conferences, and is a founding board member of Civic Hall. She's also a member of the National Board of Women of Reform Judaism. Beth Cantor is an internationally recognized thought leader in digital transformation and well-being, and she's a trainer and facilitator and sought-after keynote speaker as well. She's the author, I should say co-author, along with Allison, of The Networked Nonprofit, and also an award-winning Happy Healthy Nonprofit, Impact Without Burnout. She's been named one of the most influential women in technology by Fast Company, and she has over three decades of experience in designing and delivering training programs for nonprofits and foundations. Ladies, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast. So I have to ask you as a first question. You all seem to travel together in pairs. I noticed that when I see something written by Allison, there's usually something by Beth accompanying it. And I just want to ask you about your friendship. How did it come about? And how is it so that you've been able to achieve so much together?
Well, I'll start by telling you our meet cute story, and then Beth can pick it up from there. My first book, Momentum, came out in 2005, I think it was, and Beth was the first blogger to review it. And that was when blogging was very, very early, and we were both early in on digital, and there weren't many women in the space at that time. And I found a kindred spirit, both on thinking about whole panoply of ways that technology can be used for social good, as well as a dear friend. And we wrote the Network Nonprofit together, and now we have our second book coming out in March of next year.
Yeah, we've been writing partners for such a long time. I think people have called us the Lennon and McCarthy of the nonprofit world, and we can fight over which, who, are you Paul or am I Paul? Or do you want to be John?
Most day to day.
But, you know, one thing I do want to say, we've been thought partners, writing partners since, 15 years now? I don't want to say how many years. But what I really appreciate about our friendship and in particular about Allison and that she's a great listener. She's a fabulous collaborator because we have no egos. We're always listen to each other. We always switch, like whose name goes first on what, you know, articles. We alternate and we feel great about promoting each other's work. And Alice likes, she'll craft a first draft of something and she'll send me, go kibitz with it. So I can like do a little in this and send it back. And she's also a lot of fun and she has a great sense of humor. So, and often like with the way things work, it's, I don't know if you saw the Beatles documentary where they're sort of noodling around and then they pass things back and forth and they come up with a hit song. So we noodle a lot together and it's always a lot of fun.
Well, and all of those lovely things right back at my partner and my friend, because it doesn't work, art, unless we are even Stephen and sharing and giving and learning together. And that's what we do.
Well, that's great. Well, I have to tell this story. I have to just tell everybody that this is all about technology. We're having a conversation about technology. And, you know, we use this platform to do a podcast. And while I'm doing this wonderful interview with you two, I get a message from my computer that it's going to reboot because it wants to install updates.
Whether you like it or not.
Right.
So how about that, right? That is as real as it gets when it comes to technology. And I have my computer set to do updates automatically because I don't want to get hacked. And I want to make sure that I don't bring in foreign things to our workplace. But you also have to remember certain things too. And I didn't remember to take that off. And so I apologize for that. But it's also, I think, fortuitous in that we get to talk about the good in technology, but also some of the challenges. And I think you're focusing on both of those in your new book. So let's talk about it some. Where did the idea come from for this? Although I can imagine that in this world, it doesn't take a lot for people to appreciate how important it is to understand the good and bad in technology. But you all took the bold move to actually write about it and to try to inform us about it. So I would love to hear the genesis of it, what you're trying to achieve with it, and any other important highlights that we might get before the book comes out early next year.
So I'll kick off and then hand it to Allison. You know, all of our work, if there was a constant theme, is that we work at the intersection of social change and emerging technology. And we co-wrote the Network Nonprofit together. And that's where our friendship started, was around that very theme. And all of our writing has been about that. Why did we write the Smart Nonprofit? And I'm going to hand it back over to Allison to answer that piece of it.
So about 3 years ago, we had a conversation and asked ourselves, what's up next? We've been working in social media and digital tech for a long time, and we could see the contours of a next chapter in technology coming with what we call smart tech, which is AI and other digital technologies that do rote tasks instead of people. Right? That's why this next generation is so important. You might have a word processor that makes writing a memo faster and easier to correct, but it doesn't write it for you. What smart technology does is rote tasks like updating expense reports or answering rote questions online that only people could do beforehand. And we saw this whole generation of technology quickly becoming inexpensive and accessible, and nonprofits are starting to pull it off the shelf without realizing that it is revolutionary in its shift in power. And that's where we come in. When technology starts to change the contours of how organizations work and who's in charge and whether and how people are going to be treated well, that's when Cantor and Fine step in to try to explain it to people.
Fine and Cantor. And also not only when it disrupts the work, but when the technology has become democratized, when it's become low cost and accessible to even smaller organizations. I think Clay Shirky has this quote, technology doesn't become interesting until it becomes socially boring. And I think we're just right at that point. You know, smart technology has been plodding along in the background, humming like the refrigerator that's you see behind me in my kitchen. And we're just at that, Allison likes to talk about this, the heel of the hockey stick, where it's just going about to take off. And the research that we've done in the last couple of years, we're seeing like the early adopters of nonprofits begin to apply this work for all aspects of running a nonprofit. and also some early stage philanthropy. But now it's going to become more pervasive, and there's lots to think about. Not only are there tremendous benefits, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but there's also bad things that could happen.
You have a Harvard Business Review article out that I was reading over today, where you talk about the importance of technology being human-centered, and that it's important for leaders to take a human-centered approach to adopting these technologies and sort of find a sweet spot. Talk about the sweet spot.
So we want to live in a world where tech does what tech is supposed to do and people do what people are supposed to do. And too often, particularly when we're talking to senior leaders of organizations, they think that the technology is running on autopilot, right? It's just doing what it does, and they may not understand it well, or they haven't dug in to it, and they just want to send it down the corridor to the IT guy. And so you take care of that stuff. However, when technology is going to start to screen everybody who's applying for a job, or screen people for food or housing benefits, right? When technology becomes the gate to getting into organizations, you really need to begin to take a look of how do we ensure that people are in charge of relationship building in organizations, that people are in charge of our strategy in organizations, and we aren't leaving people out randomly. So there are a whole host of ways that we have to ensure that people are in charge of the technology. While we allow particularly this generation of technology to get rid of a lot of the administrative work that just eats up organizational time and staff time.
Well, you know, I think about this because it does have the ability to help smaller organizations accomplish a lot more, especially, right? Because maybe there are work or processes that can move a lot more quickly with a lot less in the way of resources. But at the same time, I think organizations, and I think you point this out, we have to be ready and we have to be in a position to manage the technology so that it doesn't manage us. Are we really prepared to do that?
Yeah. That's why we wrote the book, and we spent a lot of time about how do we become prepared. You know, it's not just selecting a tool and using a tool. We really have to think about ethical and responsible use when it comes to smart tech, which is based on, you know, the data could be biased or the algorithms could be biased. And it behooves us to do a lot of due diligence, not just take the vendor's word for it, talk to others who have used it. Also go through a process where we're really thinking about the end users and bringing them into the process, whether that be stakeholders or whether that be staff. So that's a lot about what we mean by being human-centered. It's not just like picking a tool and using it. And I think there's another aspect to it. We talk a lot about the benefit of this, and it's the gift or the dividend of time. You just referenced that. By getting rid of all that scut work that is so exhausting and fills our days and keeps us from getting to those really mission critical things like building relationships with donors or even just letting go of some of those tasks and have some spaciousness in our day so we're not so overwhelmed and stressed. So we have to be prepared to be thinking about how can we invest that dividend of time to make our organizations more effective?
Sure. And, you know, in the nonprofits that I've been a part of, you know, we've tried to do what we could to stay abreast of technologies and to use them as effectively as possible. But there's a cost associated with it as well. Have you seen nonprofits struggle to keep up with not only the knowledge that they need to manage these technologies well, but also find the resources? Years ago, a few of us wrote an article about the overhead myth and how donors sometimes hold charities to a certain percentage of money spent on overhead. But in order to do technology well, it seems that we have to spend money on overhead to do these technologies. What are you seeing in terms of what organizations are doing as relates to the spending on technology? It seems that our jobs as leaders of these organizations have shifted over the years from one in which we're managing processes and people to get outcomes, but the technology piece has come more central, it seems to me. I don't know what you're seeing.
Well, it certainly has increased in importance. You know, there's no benefit to an organization of taking cast off technology from corporations, which is a sector you well know was a habit that we had for a very long time. And I think and hope we've moved past the chapter of people celebrating zero overhead, which is a ridiculous kind of promise, you know, unless people are going to be standing on a street corner doing the work with no technology at all.
Right.
The revolution that's coming with smart tech is that it is becoming very, very inexpensive, but still incredibly powerful. In the same way that organizations found that when Facebook felt free, before we knew the damage that it was doing, you know, it was considered free. You didn't have to buy software. You didn't have to buy hardware. So technology is accessible for even smaller organizations, as Beth said. But just because it's accessible doesn't mean that it's the right fit for an organization, or that an organization has thought through whether they need the technology or not.
And I think also, I mean, there's the silver lining in the pandemic. I remember before the pandemic and trying to encourage some of the organizations I was working with, well, let's just do a remote meeting. Why should I travel halfway around the world and do this? We can do this online. I was like, no, no, no. I think because people had to all of a sudden shift to more remote meetings, virtual meetings, working from home, and now moving into hybrid collaboration, people had to do that really quickly. And because lives were at stake for our personal health safety reasons. And guess what? We found out we could do it, right? But were we doing it really well? And what I'm hearing a lot of course, with my other work in workplace well-being is how exhausted everybody is with so much virtual work because people just plopped everything online. Let's just make it a Zoom meeting without really thinking about how do we make this more effective? How do we like think about the difference between doing things asynchronously versus synchronously? How do we collaborate better when we're all remote? And I think that's the next phase. And a lot of organizations, as we noted in the article, also turned to smart tech because they had no choice. They had to be able to deliver their programs. And I think of one example that we wrote about when all of a sudden, when kids couldn't get there to the lunch program at school because they were learning from home. Researchers in Carnegie Mellon kind of came together and they used artificial intelligence algorithms to reinvent the bus routes. So they were bringing the food to the kids. Now that's innovative if you think about it. So I think we have this great opportunity to remake and rethink our work and to innovate our programs. And that's one of the benefits I think that this technology offers us. And so we have to be ready to do that. And that's what we write about in the book.
To build on that, Art, if you don't mind, there were food banks that got robots for the first time to do the shelving of cans because they couldn't have volunteers in. So now the robots are doing that. When the volunteers come back, the question becomes a strategic one for the organization. How do you now want to use human beings? Could those volunteers instead be used as people to have conversations with the clients or with other donors? Or, you know, what are the creative ways that we can begin to use the human capital that we have if we have robots and other tools taking over some of the rote tasks?
Well, one of the things you talk about that is particularly interesting to me is how bias can be built into algorithms, and that in many cases, these algorithms don't take into account different people of different race operate and how we live. And so we're kind of left out. Would you talk about that a little bit and what you're seeing and what you're trying to get us to pay attention to there?
I'll start and then I'll give it to Allison because she likes to talk about this. But I was just reading this article today, or was it yesterday? It was about how the people who are actually coding are mostly white males. I'll just say that like that. And so they make certain assumptions coming to either the data sets or the algorithms that result in this bias. And one example they used in the article was a form of smart tech that uses visual recognition. I'm just going to use that word rather than the technical term. And they created this software for college students who were learning remotely so it can monitor them so they wouldn't, quote, cheat. during exams. But the way that the algorithm was composed, it made the assumption that the person was cheating if there was somebody in, moving in the background. What the person who created that algorithm or the team that did that didn't take into account that the fact that there may be a lot of people of color who are in college, but they're sharing an apartment because they don't have the resources to have their own room in an apartment without somebody in the background. And what resulted was a lot of Black and brown people being flunked for a flag for cheating when in fact they weren't cheating. So that's what we're talking about. And we talk about lots of different examples in the book.
We call this embedded bias. And it's not just one thing that happens, Art. It is bias being built into the entire process, from the enormous amounts of data that are necessary for AI and smart tech. In order to get Library of Congress-sized data sets, you have to go back into historic data. So if you're working in an area like housing and you're creating AI to do the first pass for mortgage applications, you're using historic data that was racist to begin with to feed the system, right? Then you have algorithms that Beth just described. Then you have the selection of the tool or the software or the process by people who may not know what questions to ask of it. So built into the entire process of development of smart tech is the opportunity for bias to be baked in that you can't see from the outside. And that's why it is a particularly sticky problem that comes with smart tech.
You could get us to build on each other all day, so you got to be careful.
Well, you know, the one example that I read you came across was this one where a person was trying to get into a housing program, it seemed, and they had to answer a question about whether they had actually used drugs or had been kicked out of a housing program because of a drug use. And as it turned out, statistics show that white people were far more likely to answer that question truthfully. And the algorithm was actually built to support people who answered that question. Yes, you know, I have been kicked out of a program because of a drug use. So I just thought that was fascinating, and that these algorithms don't necessarily take those concerns that people have about how society operates into account.
Well, you know, think about who programmers are as well, right? They're being asked to create mathematical equations with code to solve an incredibly complicated, subtle social problem, like the one that you just raised of homeless people or people at risk of homeless being asked really sensitive questions about their background, and people of color are accustomed to being very careful about what they say about their background, particularly when it comes to drug use, and being kicked out of services or not getting being eligible for services because they answered in a way that was self-protective for them, that a coder, you know, four steps back would never have known about. So in particular, when it comes to technology that is going to be used for sensitive social interventions, social change efforts, we really need the end users involved in those discussions.
Right. So imagine, just take this example, imagine, and this is what we talk about in the book in terms of process, having an initial discussion about where do you want to use this technology? And then if we did use it this way, what are all the assumptions we're making about how this algorithm works? And are we keeping people out? And imagine having this conversation and you did have social workers in the room with the techies and program managers, and the social worker was able to point to, well, you know, the research says, or maybe they would have found this in a small pilot test. So that's a lot about the process that we talk about and being prepared, that you don't just, you know, apply it. There's kind of this testing and iteration and feedback loop. And it happens not just with a tech team, but with an integrated team of end users and people who know those end users.
Yeah, you all talk about being knowledgeable and reflective and how important it is for C-suite executives, board members, and others leading organizations to know what smart tech is and what it does, and to constantly be vigilant about the effects that it may have on what they're trying to do. Where did that notion come from? It makes all the sense in the world, but I'm just curious why you would highlight that in such a degree, to such an extent that you do.
So it's not a new issue for our work in tech to be exhorting C-suite and board members to dig in into these areas, right? We've been doing digital tech for a long time. And one of the themes from the network nonprofit art was that technology could help you take the walls down and really engage with the world and communicate with the world. And we needed the C-suite to, if not be those ambassadors, at least allow other people within their organizations to allow that to happen. And so we have this theme again of this technology is going to change your relationship with the world. It's going to change how you do your work. It's going to change who you hire and what those staff people do. Those issues are far too important, too strategic to leave to just to the IT folks or just to line staff. They are important strategic cultural issues for an organization, and it is an obligation, we think, of senior staff and board to be engaged in it.
How do you think organizations should partner with, let's say, for-profits and maybe even tech companies in ways that will drive positive social change and really highly effective use of technology, particularly these new technologies that you're talking about?
So we caution people that in the sector, we often give away a lot of power to for-profit companies, particularly tech companies. And of course, they have enormous expertise, but this is why, in particular, we want organizations to have as much knowledge and as much power as possible to be equal partners in those conversations and not just assume that the for-profits have all the answers for them.
I also think, too, that it's important to really pick and choose carefully the companies and tools that you want to use, making sure that those tech companies' values really align with your nonprofit's values, and to be very values-driven in those choices. And too often, we might skip that part because, oh, we want to get this thing done, or, oh, we saw this other organization that's similar work that we do is using this particular tool, so let's just get on the bandwagon and use that tool. What we're really talking about is a sort of a value-centered approach as well as a human-centered approach.
Well, here's a question for you that I like to ask sometimes, and it's, if you were to put nonprofits and their use of technology on a continuum, and on the left side, it's, we're going to slide backwards and be less effective in using technology, and on the right side, in 10 years, we're going to be highly more effective and solving a lot more problems, where do you think we're going to be on that? Where are you on that continuum right now in terms of where we're going to be 10 years from now?
So I'll take a stab at it. When you asked that question, it made me think about all the digital maturity or digital transformation tool assessment tools that are out there. By N10 has a wonderful one. So does NetHope and also TechSoup. And so the assessments work. There's a set of questions that ask the organizations about how they're using the tech in different departments, and they choose their answer and it feeds them back. Here's your technology profile. And it is on a continuum from kind of very nascent, scrambling, more, you know, organized, strategic, and transformed. And when I think of the field, I see organizations that are sort of throughout that continuum with a lot that are in the middle. And I think the pandemic helped move people from that low end just up a notch or two. And so I think that this kind of effective use of technology and digital transformation will always be on this continuum, because there'll always be another technology that's going to be disruptive that people are going to have to think through and get to. So I think the important thing is that people are thinking through that effective use and doing it at a pace that works for them and not trying to shortcut things.
We're also beginning to see a generational shift in leadership, Art. We're seeing this in a lot of legacy organizations during the pandemic. We're seeing a lot of retirements. And so there's an opportunity with younger folks coming up into the C-suite who grew up with digital tech, who are much more comfortable with it, to really begin to integrate tech in more strategic ways in their organization. and hopefully get a better balance of tech being able to take over a lot of the administrative rote tasks and allow people to really dig in being relational as a cultural value.
Well, you know, I want to just share with you an example of what we've been doing with technology at the Wise Giving Alliance and just get your reaction to it. It's kind of meta in some ways. We created an application using blockchain, first of all, and we think it's the first ever platform created that enables people to give money to a nonprofit and receive something in return for their data and for their donation that actually draws them closer to the charity. So we call that Give Safely, and would love for you guys to take a look at it at some point. And it's much more secure because it's blockchain and all
that's
that.
That's amazing.
When we got into it, we were really, you know, patting ourselves on the back because we took the risk to create this thing, and it's now starting to get a lot of use. So we're really excited about that. But as soon as we do that, we also find out that there's this new meta world. So now we recently acquired some property in Crypto Voxels, and we're beginning to have meetings in the meta world. So we invite people to come in and bring their digital avatar. And we actually have meetings. We have little conferences. And you know, it's fun.
There you go. Good for you.
It's just fun. You know, we could sit there and have conversations on Zoom, of course.
Yep.
But bring your avatar to work today. Yep. And let's, you know, play around in a crypto voxel world. Let's think about what we can actually do to create social good there. So obviously, you talked about nascent earlier. This is obviously very nascent, but you can see that companies and others are investing lots of money in it. Maybe it's a time for nonprofits to think about what social good can we all generate together in meta worlds? Just your thoughts.
Reminds me of Second Life, you know, about 10 years ago. I don't know if you ever, TechSoup actually had that. We had the nonprofit commons, and I think the MacArthur Foundation was actually there when they were launching their new media program. But at that point, it was super early adopter and nobody was like, what is this? And so there's always this kind of really early, there's the experiment. It was something before its time. And right now you're at that early adopter stage, but it's about now ready to really, I think, really take off. So I think you're onto something there, Art.
Well, let's see. We'll see.
Well, and some of the words you were using, Art, are really just beautiful to hear. The playfulness, the fun of this, the human connection part of it. So using blockchain, which is exactly spot on right now. And we know that for Giving Tuesday, cryptocurrency was a huge part of what was given. And then combine that with the really human engagement and the fun and the sense of abundance and curiosity is spot on. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, ladies, we're coming to the end of our interview today. And I just want to, again, congratulate you for this new book coming out, The Smart Nonprofit, Staying Human-Centered in an Automated World. Obviously, we're going to be paying a lot of attention to this book. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of attention for it. And I'm just glad that we've had a chance to sort of preview it somewhat early before it comes out. And I know that it's going to be another big hit for the two of you. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today on Heart of Giving Podcast.
Boy, it's such a pleasure, Art. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you, Art. We really enjoyed it.
Well, we'll have to get you back soon to stay abreast of many new developments that you're seeing.
Anytime you want.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving Podcast. I'm Art Taylor, your host. We're powered by bbbgive.org. And you can listen to all of our podcasts on all major podcast platforms. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And you can also support us by going to Patreon or making a gift to the Wise Giving Alliance at give.org. Thanks for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving Podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.